Welcome to Valhalla Conversations, episode 15, part 2. If you have yet to watch part 1, I encourage you to please go find it in either my YouTube channel or my Spotify channel, wherever you're watching or listening today. But if you have indeed watched part 1, then welcome back to Valhalla, and we continue our fascinating discussion with special guests Luca Panaro and Emma Thompson on the topic of Vikings in games and Norse games. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Something that's, because you mentioned, yeah, like Iceland and folklore being strangely overlooked, because of course this is where all the literature mostly survives from, but people think more about, yeah, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. Mm-hmm. Because these are the places that have these really dramatic fjord landscapes. And we have fjords in Iceland. They're just not very steep and impressive, sort of, you know, with these huge cliffs like in Norway especially. But they're still very beautiful. Yeah, but there's a game coming out that's developed by one of the many small Icelandic game studios that I think... I was unfortunately out of town for the sort of sneak peek lecture sort of thing that they did a couple, like 2 years ago, I think, but it's called Isle of Wind, and I think they're working with several folklorists on it. And instead of being set in the Viking Age, it's set in, I believe, the 17th century, and you kind of play as like a semi-seeress woman, mm-hmm. who's, I think, the premise is that many people in her probably region or district, or at least just village, have just disappeared, and she has to somehow work with like folkloric beings and sort of set balance with the, like, you know, local land spirits and things like that in order to kind of rebalance the world. So you're sort of, but the fact that it's 17th century, which we have of course way more information on the folklore and beliefs of these time periods than we do from the Viking Age or the settlement period regarding Iceland. So it's an interesting shift that people will still see and say, visually, you know, this is Viking, it's at Iceland, it's this, mm-hmm. you know, kind of, you know, a seeress vulva type that we see as a playable class in all these other Viking RPGs, but it's 17th century, so it might mm-hmm. do some interesting things, hopefully.
Interesting. Well, you heard it here first, viewers and listeners, because I certainly didn't know. And it's always good to hear about games coming out from other countries, because they do bring so much freshness and originality to us gamers that kind of like get so stuck in kind of the same studios, the same types of games. And it's nice to find other ones. Because so speaking of folklore, it made me think of Rocky. I'm probably not pronouncing it R-O with the two dot K-I, because I know that's a folklore-ish game, certainly with strong Norse elements, that I know has got some runes and some trolls and some fairies of some Norse type, but it's all about a girl going around unlocking the history and mystery of her father and mending the kind of bond between them. I haven't played it, heard wonderful things, I've got the soundtrack and it's very, very beautifully written, but I know that's delving more into kind of Norse folklore than the Norse full pantheon, like the gods and the giants and the elves and that kind of thing. And of course, dwarves keep coming up in all sorts of games, and of course in fantasy literature and tabletop games, because of course you can play as a dwarf, you can play as an elf, you can't play as a giant, they've come as close as a Goliath, and that's about where they've stopped. Of course the DM can play as a giant, good or bad. And of course, I remember, Emma, you running that wonderful little one-shot that was set in a very special, I keep calling it special, it's special to me because I got to be a very old vulva in it and I kept doing bad roles and I just kept blaming it all on my character's age.
You really did have some terrible roles. I felt really bad because you often brought your own dice, you had your dice mat, and they were just like, nah, not today.
It's fine. Sometimes that's the best bit. Sometimes that's the best bit. But because that delve certainly kind of like the historical aspect, although it has got a bit touch of the mythology into it. Can you tell us what title of that little one shot was?
Yeah, so the one shot I ran for you guys at the symposium is called The Final Voyage of Drengarthar, which is by JC Connors, and it's on One Shot Adventures, the website. He's done it for D&D 5th edition, which is what we played, but I think it's also for GURPS and some other systems as well. Basically, the premise is that, you know, powerful warlord Drengathar goes missing. Well, not so much missing. He's stranded on an island. He sends some of his men to go get help. You return as the adventuring party with some Norse-flavored individuals. So there's a berserker, there's a Volver, sort of magic user. And you kind of slowly uncover, you know, that this island is infested with Draugr, with undead, and you have to save your warlord from becoming one himself. And obviously there's some things about, you know, messing with Valhalla and eating beasts that you shouldn't and things like that. And yeah, kind of the reason why, well, part of the reason why I ran that was because sort of the organizers went, oh my God, you're doing a paper on D&D. Why don't we just do D&D, which was fun. But also I think tabletop is a really interesting thing to study in the sense of, even with video games as interactive as they are, there's a point where they're finite. There's only so much people can do with a video game before you have to just, it has to ship, you have to make money at some point. Whereas tabletop can really just become and keep becoming anything. So what I've been wanting to do with this research is not just look at kind of the supporting text, but also what players do when given free rein with Viking characters and what kind of preconceptions they're bringing to the table. So it was interesting that the conference one shot that I ran, so I've run this game 5 times in total, and the conference one was the best behaved. Everyone else were really like, how do we break Emma? Which is obviously another fun aspect of Dungeons and Dragons, of how do we break our friend who's running this game for us?
Amazing.
Well, I can still remember there was a particular moment in our little one shot where we came across a undead, well, say undead, it became undead. That's what we all feared. It was a dead body on a tree, covered in tooth, and there was a raven and it had something in its beak. And I think, what was it? One of the other characters / players spoke to the raven, a new chord, and they said, ah, he dropped it then because it opened its mouth.
Yeah.
That was me.
Yeah.
It was you, Noka.
It was really funny because at no point in any of the other games had anyone gone, yeah, the bird has just vocalized, so it drops the thing in its mouth. And then you guys were like, yeah, clearly that's what happens. And they went, yep, I can't argue with you there. You're right. The next time
totally
I ran the game after you guys, I was like, nope, it's under its talon. It's not in its mouth.
Okay.
So I learned my lesson.
Very good.
It is sometimes sneaky when we bring in reality and physics and science, just the act of gravity.
Look, yes. I know Viking Age facts. I don't know physics. Please don't bring physics to a tabletop.
Oh, but it was a really fun one shot. And I keep thinking, if and when we kind of get to the end of my current in-person tabletop game at my local gaming shop, I might just pull that out and run that for my friends.
Yeah.
Just do some it. Fun.
Yeah. Just quickly on what Emma said about the sort of differences between the limits of computer versus tabletop, that conversely, like as the graphics have become much, much higher fidelity, and that's where we kind of draw our immersion from, all the fact that you can look around, everything's really hi-fi, and there's a immersive soundtrack, like for something like Senua or Hellblade. All of these things kind of, and these are heavy sort of data loads on the file and on the console that require fancier and fancier computers to run. But back in the day, with like the earlier, there's a very nerdy, long video essay that I watched about the Elder Scrolls. And the not the first one, but the second Elder Scrolls, Daggerfall, supposedly the in-game map, because it was procedurally generated and looked like, you know, pixels, variously colored pixels, limitedly colored pixels, rather. But was procedurally generated. Supposedly, the extent of the in-game map was equivalent to the real-world United Kingdoms, with cities, with like hundreds of thousands of NPCs in them, or something insane like this. And it was sort of the trade-off is you lose, and the games have become more and more simplified to the way you lose. You know, in Daggerfall, you could supposedly, you know, scale up your you know, your thievery skills and your acrobatic skills to the extent where you could become some sort of roof climbing, you know, cat burglar type person. And you can't really do that in something like Skyrim or whatever the next Elder Scrolls that they'll release is eventually. These sort of more freedom, free aspects of that you have in D&D have been scaled back as graphical fidelity has become the sort of mainstay of the RPG genre. So you can still, you know, you can't talk to a bird and make it drop a key. So that's not designed. And even when it's designed, you can still somehow make the DM, you can convince the DM, you cannot convince a computer that you're right.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting point, because it makes me think to Assassin's Creed Valhalla, where it always irks me that you can ride across half the country in about 10 minutes. It's too small. And of course, to touch on our early topic about Vikings and always being in cold places, they have, of course, made the north of England cold. It's winter. And yet in the rest of the land, it's spring or summer. And I'm like, how? That does not geographically, climately happen. It just doesn't. But I guess it's almost echoing kind of like the Game of Thrones and kind of like the North and the Wall and all the ice people, and that's where they come from.
What's quite interesting though, thinking about what you're saying about crossing England in sort of no amount of time whatsoever, is in Dungeons and Dragons, for example, in the handbook, it sort of tells you this is how many miles a horse can do a day before you might need to roll for exhaustion because you're pushing the horse too hard. That's actually easier to embed in a video game, in the sense of you put some code in that's like, the horse has been riding for X many miles, pop up with something that says the horse needs to rest. Whereas in D&D, as a DM, you have to go, how many miles have they traveled? And like, have they done it fast? Have they been pushing the horse? Have they been feeding the horse? Often they don't feed the horse. So it's easier to actually embed that realism into the video game versus tabletop. But I actually think tabletop accounts more for it. It gives you more of a like a, you should be doing this and this costs this much, and so on and so on.
Yeah, if you choose to make this type of gameplay kind of more, you know, realistic or gritty sort of survivalist style, then there's many suggestions and rule sets to sort of enable that type of gameplay. And people do this, usually players choose to add these things through modifications or mods in video games. There's another one of us few Old Norse game scholars, Victoria Cooper, has written an article about modding like gritty realistic medievalism into Skyrim by like making, you know, more advanced weather systems. There is a survival mode in the one of the, you know, the Skyrim anniversary edition. They made this mode called survivalism, where you have to eat and rest and get warm and things like that. The players have pushed that further and made it more realistic with all kinds of things. And so this is something that players want, and so they custom make this content for their games sometimes when it's possible.
Interesting. It certainly brings me back kind of like memories, of course, not quite of a Viking game, but of Sims, because of course in Sims you've got to eat, sleep, go buy food, cook the food, clean up, or you get rats, and all sorts. It is almost like a reflection of the rules of D&D, kind of like how many rules do you want to add, how many conditions do you want to try and jump and challenge through. And in terms of survival games, there's one that I have played a bit, and I played it during its beta phase as well as its alpha phase, which is called Tribes of Midgard. I don't know if either of you two have heard of that one. It's very mythological based, and I have to say, I do quite like the style of it, and I did get some of the cats. These are exclusive cats. This is one. This is called Sonia. They do have Norse names, but don't ask me to pronounce them. And then they have this one, which is a moon claw. And there were only 300 produced because they wanted to give money to a cat charity on their third year anniversary.
That's so sweet.
My daughter likes them too. Thankfully, she's happily sharing them with me. It's on my desk and keep me company. It reminds me that I still need to go and play, because I do quite like it. It's got two styles. You can either have story mode or survival mode, and it's for online players, so you can buddy up with your friends if they've got the game of it. You've got skins, so you can look at like armor. My friend James Aitchison, he got me the special edition, which gave me the Valkyrie armor skin, which is quite cool. So even though my armor is very low level, I look impressively awesome. But you kind of, again, you have to chop down trees and get the twigs to make the timber to make your armor, armor the house, and get berries and certain ingredients to make certain things, in terms of ore and flint and stone to make equipment, then make tools. it's not as heavily farming as the previous game that I mentioned that Joss Christian's involved. You don't die from starvation and cold in this one, thankfully. They've taken an hour, but every night there's these hell things that come out and try and get to your little seed of Yggdrasil, which is growing, and takes all the souls of all the animals that you kill, basically. Because you've got goose, you've got pigs, you've got deer, you've got wolves, which they will attack you if you run into them. We've also got foxes and that kind of thing. But they've got different lands where they've got draugr, they've got giants. They've got, I think they've had 4 expansions since it came out properly. And you can face Jormungand, you can face Fenrir, you can face Hel. And then the last one, I believe, you can face Loki, but they've never really revealed that one because they want players to go and find it. So, but that's what I think. But you're basically, Iron Harrows are just like on a holiday down in this land where you just survive until you go up to Valhalla, basically. But the mythology is really deeply ingrained in every aspect of it. So I remember coming across the recipe for like the level 2 sword, and it was called Signy's Revenge. Because of course, not many people know about Signy, or Signy, if I can get the name right, which is Loki's wife, who's there holding the bowl of poison and taking it away and letting Loki trash and putting it back. And of course, it's a nice odd to how deep they've gone into the pantheon. They're not just gone with the classic of Odin, Thor, and Heimdall, and Frey, and Loki, and that. They've actually nodded to all the other ones as well. Mm-hmm. It's fun. It takes time. I only ever play it on my own because I don't have many players. Don't have many friends who play games, typically. So I'm often on solo games, usually. So I am on solo survival mode, which is where kind of like the days are longer and the nights are slightly shorter, but you've got no impending threat. Whereas if you're in story mode, the hell thing kind of like gets stronger as you get stronger, and then you've got to go and expand and find the bosses and get the loot and treasure. It was interesting. It's a fun little game to play. Hard one on your own, but it's fun. By Norsefell, a Canadian studio, I think, because I know they're doing a lot of their posts in French as well. Mm. So I'm assuming Canadian. I could be wrong. but yeah, so that's a nice one. And as you can tell, I kind of bought in because I got the merchandise. But what other games? In terms of kind of like touching off computer games for a bit, I've certainly got a couple of Norse table games, tabletop games. One I've got is called, I think it's called Raven's Race, and it's a kind of two.
I love that one. It's so like simple and cute, and yeah, it's a very good one. I feel like you're about to explain it, so I will let you.
By all means. I mean, I think it's called Raven's Race. I know it involves Hunan and Munin, and you've got little cards that represent the realms, and it's almost a bit like dominoes that you've got to match them up to help your ravens get all the way around. You kind of like each person's going anti-clockwise to the other one, so you can overlap there, and you can also cheat if you get like a low card and make the other raven get lost and go around the wrong way, or
It's kind of like a loop of cards, and each raven starts at sort of one end, and you can basically move the cards up and down, and that screws over the other raven in terms of two cross realms. They have to be of a certain type, and you can change the type on them. It's basically about who gets their raven back to Odin first. But it's very simple, and the art style on the cards is really nice. It sort of has the different realms on it, and it's just a very simple nod to Viking mythology, which I think is quite engaging. It's a quick, easy game, and obviously a lot of board games can be very rule intensive and daunting in terms of just approaching a box and going, you know, we need to spend an hour before we can even play the game. So I think it's quite a good to come into it.
Going back at least 9 years now, back before pandemic was even a blip on the horizon, and when I had some more local D&D friends, when we couldn't play a D&D game, we'd often play other games instead if like one player was missing. And I know they got out, I can't remember the name, but it was some kind of strategic Norse game, but it was kind of resource-based. They each played like a Jarl-type character, a prominent figure in this Norse society, and he had to collect enough water, enough food, enough ships, enough gold, that kind of thing. And whoever had the most resources won at the end, basically. So that was an interesting one. And I do have another one. In fact, I've got two to show off, ladies and gentlemen. Bear with me. I will disappear and into the hall. Into the hall beyond.
She's in the fire.
It was by the cooking pots. I have them. They're here. And the first one is this one. All thingy. this is a good one to play. I think I've only ever played it twice, and it's a very good strategic game. Set in Iceland, more historical than fantastical. Card game, again, you've got to kind of like match resources to select the right members of the cards, because all these characters on here, dear viewers and listeners, well, many viewers, because you can see, listeners, you need to join me on YouTube so you can see. they're all characters based on sagas or almost literature at the time, and you've got to recruit them because you're I've forgotten the word. Does the box tell me?
Huff thingy? I don't know. Like a headman? Gozy? Yeah, Gozy.
I want to say alpha, but it's the wrong word. It's not quite a jarl, because that's very much a Norwegian thing, but you're basically a chieftain of sorts in one of the four regions of Iceland. And so you recruit people, and then after recruiting people with your resource cards, because some people like certain things, they then have kind of like a home gang at the end of the day, and you put forward your champion, and then the resource cards become a weapons card or an armor card, and then whoever has the most numbers. It's a very good counting game, I will say that. It's not as intense as D&D in numbers, but it's there. And then you kind of like get points if you win the most home games that night. And then it's kind of like a day rotation, and it carries around. But yeah, this was designed by a really cool guy called Joshua Gilligan. He's actually in an early episode, I think he was episode 11, in fact, in January. So do go listen to my episode and talk to him about it. But he's done an expansion pack called Saga Heroes. Again, I haven't played that pack yet, but it basically is another supplement of characters to go with the All Thingy One Will Rise card game. So do recommend, go find that at Outland Entertainment. That's where you can get this beauty. And then this one is still in its cellophane, ladies and gentlemen, because I've not even opened it yet. This is what I treated to myself at the Orvik Festival this year. Mm. It's Viking Raiders, because it's got an award. I thought, well, it must be a good game if it's got an award. And this simply says on the back, you are a merciless Viking chief on a mission to get the biggest navy, the largest clan, and the most loot. So again, I'm thinking resource management and collection. Mm-hmm. But there's raiding, plundering, and interference from the Norse gods. Always a bonus. And you will feel totally Viking-y from the first draw until long after the final backstabbing and bloodthirsty move. Well, I am hooked already. I just need someone to play it with. You all need to move nearer to me. You're all moving too far away. So I don't know if either of you two have come across those two games or heard them, played them. If not, don't worry.
Yeah, I'd heard of All Thingy, but no, I hadn't. And maybe I've seen Viking Raiders, but no, not played them. I think we kind of touched upon this with board games and probably tabletop role playing as well. Video games have kind of got tutorials down to an art at this point. Like, so many video games have done tutorials, they know exactly how you're supposed to get the player onto things. Board game rules can be really, really dense. And I know so many people who go to these board game cafes and they will just pick the same board games up again because they know how to play and it just saves your time. So it's
right.
It looks to me like Viking Raiders is the kind of game that sort of makes it as simple to get into as possible. I imagine All Thingy is maybe a bit denser on the rule set, but it's interesting, I guess, in terms of the tabletop stuff being role-playing or board games, how much pressure there is on whoever is the designated rules lawyer to kind of adequately draw people in compared to a video game, which is programmed and has loads of people kind of giving feedback on how to engage the player.
Yeah, when I was in New York visiting after the last IMC, I think I went 2 years ago. Oh Lord. We did stop in like a, you know, kind of pop culture game store. Mm. And there was this, I think it's this game, I've looked it up, called Veður.
Mm.
And it's spelled with just a D instead of an F, but I think it was this one. It was either this or something called Reykjolt or something. It's just something very Icelandic. But this description is very amusing. That Icelanders have always been obsessed with the weather, including today. So it's entirely around, you know, kind of mixing Viking and modern Icelandic preoccupations with the weather into some kind of board games, though. But I always see these really interesting ones that pick up very niche Norse words or topics. And I'm always fascinated by the spelling, too. That's one of my weird foci, I guess, like with the one you just showed us, Becky, Alfingi, the fact that it's Alfingi with the I, but a TH, and it's like, well, they have to have a TH because otherwise people will say all pingy when they have a thought. But then most people know what the all thing is if you're sort of an aficionado of Viking stuff. But they won't necessarily understand why there's an I tacked on at the end. So the kind of mix of types of pressures when it comes to like using words and names and things like that is always very interesting to me.
You might like to look up a campaign source book called When the Wolf Comes by Mr. Ian Stewart Sharp, aka, as I call him, Mr. Vikingverse, because his brain is enormous on this subject. Okay. Because it's basically Vikings in space in a very futuristic, doomed, as if the Scandinavian people basically invented everything that disregard kind of like the Far East, the West, us in Europe. They did everything. They made science, they made medicine, they made technology, and Odin just gave them the winning card every time, basically. He's just defying the norms. And so in this alternate universe, everything is deeply Norse, and how he says a lot of the words, I can't get over, I can't pronounce them. I had the honour and privilege and shame, in a way, of being on his actual play podcast called Vikings and Valkyries. My character kind of died. But that's all I'm going to say, because spoilers, because there's 22 episodes out there. Please do go listen to it. It's a lot of fun, but nearly every episode has a character death. That's what I will say. As his tagline goes, don't get too attached to the characters at the table. But that is deeply Norse. A lot of his linguistics is really, I think it definitely honours, if not reflects, Old Norse really well. I know I tried to recruit Emma to get on the podcast, but things are busy in your life, and that's understandable. It's understandable.
I can barely schedule my own D&D.
Oh, don't talk to me about scheduling D&D, because I've had not one, but two D&D games cancelled this week because of scheduling issues. As we call them, scheduling gremlins, they get everywhere. I think we just all need to have dedicated hour of almost worship. We just all have an hour of D&D every week. But that one is good if you're interested in Old Norse linguistics and games. And of course, that is taking Vikings, both the history and the mythology, completely beyond in different angles to being either mythological or historical. But I know he is revising When the Wolf Comes to make kind of like almost a sequel expansion. I can't for the life of me, and I apologise, Ian, please forgive me, remember the title of it. He did announce it when I interviewed him back in March, so please go watch that early episode. But he's, instead of setting it in its futuristic tense context, he's bringing it back into the historical, and he's not sending it in Europe, he's not setting it in Scandinavia, not even in Iceland, not even in Greenland and Newfoundland. He's setting it in Constantinople, or otherwise known as Miklagard to the Vikings. Yeah. And that's a really interesting place to put them. And thankfully, when he reveals the cover on the episode, there are no horned helmets in sight. But he's still revising it, kind of like keeping the same rules, but obviously making different classes, different contexts. And there's a bit of almost settlement building, very similar in the way of Assassin's Creed, where you have Valhalla, where you go and get a settlement and you have to build it and you get extra boons and benefits. But I know that mechanics involved in his next expansion coming up, and I believe he'll be kickstarting that one hopefully later at some point this year. He's told me he'll let me know. So I will let you all know, dear viewers and listeners, and anyone else interested, because I certainly will be, because I got my own NPC artwork in the first one, so I might do if he offers it as another extra kind of like initiative to get money in. I might throw more money in and get my artwork done again. So that, I think that's the only one I've come across out of all my other Norse inspired source books that touches on it historically. Nearly all of them are very fixed in the mythology and then the magical and fantastical side of things. Because I know I've got Spilland, which I know Emma is familiar with, because that was on your list at your presentation. And I've recently, they've got an expansion to their source book, so I've thrown money at that one for that one as well. I don't know if I'll ever play these, ladies and gentlemen, but I just like looking at the artwork, especially because I know Spilland did have a Valkyrie NPC character type. I thought, oh, she actually gained kind of like boons or woes depending on who she wants to die or survive kind of thing. That was a really interesting use of the Valkyrie mechanic. But there was another one called Journey to Ragnarok, mm-hmm. by Manor Project Studio, I think. Yep, got their beautiful books. I've done a little humble unboxing video on my YouTube channel as well, if anyone wants to go look at that. And I know they actually announced a while back, back before Christmas, that a D&D group that streamed their plays on Twitch were doing it. And because one of the players wanted to be a Valkyrie, they deliberately then invented a Valkyrie class. Mm-hmm. And then they told that to the studio, Manor Project Studio, then Manor Project Studio then made that available. I haven't actually downloaded it already. Mm-hmm. I have bookmarked the email. It's been bookmarked for a very long time. But again, because Valkyries are my catnip, ladies and gentlemen, if you've met me already, I mentioned nearly every episode, really. I'm always interested in how that's interpreted, because it's such a different stance from Shield Maidens or Wolves of women in Norse games, of course.
Yeah, I think the interesting point about Svillund and Journey to Ragnarok is these are both campaign settings or module extensions for Dungeons & Dragons. So these will tend to lean as far into the fantasy elements as possible, because in theory, these settings are set up so an existing adventuring party who've gone around Faerun, which is sort of Dungeons & Dragons' default continent, can go off to these lands and still work as normal. So that's kind of where that leaning into fantasy comes there. But there are a couple which lean more historical, but not many. It's usually in that at least pseudo mythical space, if not outright fantasy. But that also kind of is because of how combat heavy a lot of these games are. It's a case of, if we were really realistic with combat and it was just people with swords, people with axes, people with bows, you know, still fun, but you're kind of playing the same character as everyone else. So magic gives you a lot more to play with in terms of, I get to do this and you get to do something completely different, and combat synergy and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, I forget how much I went into this in my Stavanger presentation of the article. But in the actual written article, I go a bit, sort of a little bit with Assassin's Creed Valhalla, about how it tries to establish itself as sort of like a historically realistic depiction of Viking Age England. As problematic as anybody who studies the Viking Age will tell you its representation is, but regardless, there's some sort of inherent synergy, like Emma was discussing, between these more heroic mythic settings and the action of games, with their sort of default as being this power fantasy. And of course we have like disempowerment fantasies in the form of like horror games, where all you can do is run away and you have no way to fight back against monsters and things like that. But by and large, the majority of games are power fantasies, especially RPGs. And so it's even in this historically accurate representation of Viking Age England that they try to create with all of these, you know, actual academic consults and historical research that they do on these games, the reality that they kind of depict still looks more like one of these superhuman saga heroes who's able to, you know, just kill 50 men in a single battle single-handedly. You know, several times in a 5-hour play session or something, you're just killing hundreds of people, and your allies are helping, but you're doing the heavy lifting. So you're one of these, you know, A.L. Scott Lagrimson, Sigurdr type, you know, mythic heroic, on the border of, you know, written history and the mythic past, where there's monsters and gods walking amongst us. So this sort of this part of games brings this out, even in settings where they're trying to be historically accurate to a certain degree. It becomes more literary, heroic, and mythic.
Yeah, I mean, even within, as you say, Assassin's Creed Valhalla, there is that kind of spin-off adventure where you're basically impersonating Odin. Everyone calls you Odin, even though you're clearly not. And then it's basically their retelling of the Norse story arc. I remember when I first encountered it, and then you have to protect the builder who's putting up the magical wall, because it's not a stone wall, as in legends say, and there is no magic cause either. But he's there, and you've got to fix it, and you've got to fight off the Jotun that are swamping you single-handed. Found that rather intense. So it's like, no, I'm really dead. Can you just hurry up and fix the wall? I'm trying to hit them as many times as I can. But yes, that's another interesting take. There was one game, and I'm going to hopefully open Steam without ruining the recording. Where is my wish list? Wish list, because there's one game that actually made me think of that isn't combat stuff. It kind of links back to, oh, this was it, Choice of the Viking. Have either of you heard of that before?
Is this the one that Declan helped with?
Yes, Declan, that was his name. I wanted to call him Eric. No, Rebecca, that's not the right name. But
no, yeah, Declan Taggart. I think he's done another one too, or he's consulted / worked closely with the people who actually do the sort of game coding, I think. I haven't played this one because I went to click the link on his Twitter back in the day when he first mentioned it to me, and it was a dead link. So I'll email him about this to get the real link, and then I never did, because that's what always happens when you say you will do something.
Because I know I was reading the blurb for that, and obviously I recognised the name, because I remember being at, I think it was at the Richard Hall Symposium one year, or it might have been the Midlands Viking Symposium, one of the two. I've been to another of them back before COVID and becoming a parent, and that was where he was speaking about Thor and how he doesn't really create thunder and this, that, and the other, and his brilliant thesis, which I keep thinking of buying and then seeing the price of and then shying away again. But it's a really interesting topic. But I remember reading the blurb for that and how it is almost echoes of the text-based games back in the day where you have choices. And I remember looking at the reviews, and some of them are good. There's some that's like, but where are the visuals? Where are the graphics? I didn't want just text. I'm like, did you not read the blurb? It's
no.
I keep meaning to try that one as an interesting thing. And I think there was one other game on my wish list which was similar.
Right, there's something really amusing about being upset with a text-based game when you didn't read the blurb. Can you read?
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Why isn't it on my? I'm sure it was called Sailing or something like that, and it has a similar premise. But certainly speaking of games coming out, one of my wish lists isn't even really early access yet, and that's simply called Viking Saga / Echoes of Midgard. I thought, well, it's got the word Viking in it and Midgard in it, so that's getting on my wish list.
I do always find it funny how certain words reappear in titles so much. Like, it made me laugh when obviously God of War Ragnarok came out, and then Assassin's Creed's DLC was Assassin's Creed Valhalla Ragnarok, and it's just like, right, yeah, we know what to expect. Yeah. Guys.
Yeah. I went to my own list in a note program to be like, I think I've heard of that one. I think I remember that one that was on, like, oh, it's forthcoming. No, it wasn't that. It's called Viking Ashes, Survivors of Ragnarok. So it's another something Viking title, Ragnarok of something. It's always the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because another one on my wish list is, of course, Norse, Oath of Blood, because I don't know, it's Norse Viking, Midgard, obviously, comes up a few times. You've got Niflheim, which is kind of like left or right playable game. Again, you've just got to fight your way out of Niflheim. Expeditions Viking, Valheim, mm-hmm. and of course, Northgard, which is another successful survivalistic type strategy map based game that I keep hearing not of and keep thinking I will play maybe one day. Because so many of these games are quite time intensive, aren't they? And I think that is partly what you said, Emma, about the rules and the mechanics involved. Whether it is simply you've got to make the clothes before you freeze, or you've got to kill the wolves before they eat you, or you've got to conquer that land before they conquer yours. I can think of one game actually that isn't quite time intensive, and that's simply called Bad North. Mm. Have I really heard of that one?
Yeah.
It's what they call a roguelite. I personally keep finding the words rogue and light very confusing, because how can you be a roguelite? But yeah, I think I keep needing to look up the dictionary definition of what roguelite means, but I just keep thinking, okay, roguelite means it can be played in short bursts. That's the way I understand it. And it's a fun little strategic game, very beautiful, artistically made, nice, tranquil music soundtrack. And it's basically like if you imagine like the Hebrides and Shetlands, but with Faroes all mixed together, but then mixed up. There's loads of little islands, different shapes, different houses. And you play the captain or the guy, well, not quite the captain, yeah, the captain or the leader of a little squad. You start off with two, and if you save some people on the island, then you get three, and you can, every time you save, stop a house from burning from the bad Vikings. That's why it's called Bad North. And again, this connection with Vikings and the North is not set in like the bad Midlands or the bad seas. It's the bad North, yeah. Not even the bad South. But you've got to stop these Vikings. And like little tiny little blob-like characters, it's very simplified. So there's still bloodshed. You can turn the blood effects off if you don't want the bloodshed. I just find it's just funny splatter, really. It just makes me laugh. But they have little pictures and little Anglo-Saxony type or Norse-esque names. A lot of the islands have names that make me think of the Faroes and the Shetlands. And you've got to keep going. As you go, you kind of like your army gets leveled up with gold through awarding boons and armor and skills and upgrades, and then equally the enemies get leveled up and upgraded, and you come across berserkers, which can only be defeated by pikemen, and you've got archers that can actually hit your guys better than your archers can. And me and my husband have tried playing it together, and that he'll do an island and then I'll do an island. We'll sometimes say, oh look, that bit's coming from the north, that bit's coming from the south, turn around, because you can rotate the camera so you get a 360 degree visual. But that's quite a fun little game to play, I would recommend it.
It's funny you say like bad Midlands or whatever, because there is a game that's been announced recently that I thought was a joke at first, which is called God Save Birmingham or something like that. And it's set in 17th century Birmingham, and like zombies come out, and I genuinely thought it was a joke, and I was just like, oh, this is a real game, and this looks quite good. But it's such an interesting choice for setting, given that 1600s Birmingham is not normally the choice. But I guess it's sort of suggests something about, like, you know, where are the weird places we could set our Viking games, which are a bit sort of different to the norm. And maybe it is the Midlands. Do a Repton Torxie game.
Yeah. That's very funny, though.
I genuinely thought it was a joke, because obviously Birmingham's not doing too well in the press right now. So I was just like, oh, haha, someone's made a trailer for God Save Birmingham. It's like, oh, no, this is a legitimate game. Okay.
Yep.
Are there any other games that we haven't talked about that you would recommend or think people might like if they're into Vikings and all stuff, mythological or historical, or that you personally just really like and you want to promote?
It would be less about a specific game, I guess, and just, you know, theoretically anyone watching this podcast is at least just interested tangentially in Vikings.
So. And
Norse. Yeah, maybe they've just
really stumbled afar. Yeah,
into yeah. But it's one of the really fascinating parts of how Viking stuff ends up in video game worlds and gameplay mechanics is how it usually ends up totally decontextualized and in really strange places, especially in sci-fi. Because of the close-knit history of fantasy and sci-fi, both as literary genres and as mainstays of role-playing games, the two main types, you either have a sci-fi role-playing game or a fantasy role-playing game, or one that blends both elements. So you often find space Vikings, like the type that you were talking about. Stuart Sharp kind of runs the sort of space Viking campaign, but it's usually just one-off references to things like a rocket launcher in Destiny and Destiny 2 that's called Gjallarhorn, the horn of Heimdall. And I find it quite funny that it's a rocket launcher. Why do they choose this? The horn is loud and a rocket launcher is probably pretty loud. So maybe that's the extent of it. In a game I used to play a ton of called Warframe, which is probably the least Viking game that you could get. It's robotic space ninjas basically running these very fast-paced shoot 'em up kind of hack and slash combination with, you know, magic in the form of technology type stuff. But you have one of the first Warframes, these kind of robot ninjas that you can control, is called Loki. And he's special. He looks nothing like, he sort of has a pointy head, but that's it. Maybe those are horns, I don't know. But his skill set is based in, you know, trickery and deception and stealth. So it's more thematic than it is, you know, just Loki from Norse mythology. But it's like, oh, like we have like a trickster pretty up Loki. Of course. So now there's Loki in space beating up post-humans and things like that.
That's also just triggered a thought for me in terms of, so Final Fantasy VII is not my Final Fantasy. Final Fantasy X is where I'm at, but Final Fantasy VII has a lot of Norse realm names in it.
It has a ton of Norse stuff in general in it, actually.
I haven't played VII properly, but I was in a room while someone was playing it and just the ears poking up being like, hold on, why is this Final Fantasy game referencing Norse realms all the time? So it is interesting where it crosses over.
Yeah, actually, that one's the kind of the heaviest with these references, because like you said, it's set in the city of Midgar.
Mm-hmm.
No D or N, just Midgar. Mm-hmm. The main character's from a town in the kind of north foggy place called Nibelheim with two B's. But things like especially Odin as like a summon, this sort of special ability that you can use every now and then has been, I think, since Final Fantasy 3 or 4. And he reoccurs very frequently.
Mm.
And Ragnarok is usually a sword that you can get in the game, like a very high level special sword or. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a sword. But Seven is kind of the heaviest on these references.
Yeah.
I'm actually currently co-writing an article on a JRPG that's the Norse influence, and we're sort of me and my co-writer are trying to puzzle out what's up with Japanese receiving kind of Western fantasy, Western medieval fantasy in general, but the Viking stuff in particular, because it's so popular right now, and they're starting to make more kind of Viking games through the Japanese pop culture lens of anime and manga and JRPG conventions instead of Western RPG conventions.
It's a good point, because I remember many months ago sending you a link to a new game that was coming out that looked very distinctly Norse, and then you pointed out that's actually coming from Japan. I'm like, I wouldn't have guessed from the way the characters in the world was depicted.
Yeah.
Because it's so malleable and adaptable.
Was it Japanese?
I can't remember the name off the top of my head because, you know, my memory is rubbish.
it was
interesting because then you pointed out that they'd used a particular symbol at one point and you were like, it was a bit questionable. Yeah,
they had a curved swastika on a shield at the very last minute. I was like, they have to sneak it in there. There can't not be some sketchy symbol in these games, I swear.
But I think you can customize your shield. Yeah. I mean, I do wonder kind of like those who are very familiar with runes, both kind of like as a written language and, of course, their many meanings that people kind of associate with them, kind of like how painful they find it when they see runes used in games. Because that's another common trope that's come along from Norse mythology and Viking culture that's used in games. It's often got a magical connotation. It's never used as
everywhere. Yeah.
Common sense of carving a message into a stone, because that's where they often are found for on items and things. Certainly it's made me think, actually, because before today I sent you both a link that Bethsaida had put on their Instagram account, because they've done something rather uniquely crazy for their next Doom game, which is called Doom Dark Age. Might as well place the word dark with many evil, but it was also, there was an era known as the Dark Ages, so I think that's what they're leaning into. They've made their own mock version of the Bayeux Tapestry, but about Doom and the Doom Slayer. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. And they've put it up in the Armory in Leeds, of all places. So it doesn't, I must admit, he uses a shield of sorts. It rotates and has daggers and slices up things very nicely, but that's about the main only artifacts I can see that looks anything kind of like medieval or Viking Age-ish. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are Norse references in there too, whether it is, as you say, applied to weapons or items or armor upgrades, that kind of thing. Because, of course, it's set in hell. I don't think that hell is definitely not the Norse hell. It's very much demons and zombies and undead and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
It's one of those types of games I couldn't play because it's just too violent. Because again, I'd get mobbed. I can't dock Hampton's Lodge kind of thing. I can watch my husband play it, but I couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, even the previous two rebooted Doom games, Doom from 2016, I think, and Doom Eternal, its sequel, I think Dark Ages 1 is a prequel, which is why they're going back to the Middle Ages. But even especially Doom Eternal had a lot of dark medieval fantasy aesthetics, where you're not always just in hell. You're either in space, on these alien / heavenly divine planets. You're in hell, or you're in the home planet of these the people who sort of created and trained the Slayer, who are these combination like sci-fi order of knights, kind of Spartan society that live in space, and they have extremely advanced technology, but they choose to live in big generic medieval castles, and they use technology, but they choose to use iron gates and things like that. So there's already sort of a heavy blending of dark fantasy medievalism with sci-fi elements in the game, so they're just leaning all the way into that and making a knockoff Bayou Tapestry thing, which is just really amusing to me.
It is. I will try and find the link and put it in the blurb below for any viewers and listeners that don't believe me, but it is real. I don't know if it's still there. I only came across it. It literally popped up through the wonders of the Instagram algorithm. It somehow must have connected that I like games or something.
You were blessed.
There you go. But yes, it'll be something interesting to see how well Norse does when that comes out later this year. And of course, I don't think I'm aware of any of the computer games certainly touching on the historical aspect of Vikings. There's a lot more coming out that, again, deal with the fantastical and the mythological aspect. Mm-hmm. I guess that relates to what you said in a previous podcast on Nordic mythology, Luca, about how much fantasy and fantasy literature has that's kept Vikings and Norse mythology particularly malleable in the context of games and interactive storytelling in a way.
Yeah, it's like I was saying with the sci-fi stuff, it's everywhere in these kind of either discrete elements. I mean, you can already say that there's in Doom the Dark Ages, just quickly, there's a dragon. The Western fantasy dragon is inherently kind of rooted in Norse, Old Norse and Old English culture. The greedy kind of gold hoarding dragon is this Northern European dragon. So that's technically a little Norse reference, but it's been refracted and reflected and re-represented and channeled through so many layers of history and intermeeting text that it's lost all of its kind of flavor in the sense. But now it's just kind of part of the stock imagery. Especially of dark fantasy with heavy metal soundtracks.
We also touched upon this earlier in the sense of the Viking Age in particular, of all of medieval Europe, quotation marks, is probably the most ripe for playing with these fantasy tropes, because we don't have written evidence apart from a few runic sources from the Viking Age proper, like Viking Age Scandinavia. We haven't got writings from, everything's around it or beyond it. So it really is a blanker canvas to play with in a lot of medieval Europe. So you can fill in those gaps with the fantasy elements. And a lot of the tabletop designers will say as much. They'll say, we stuck to history where we could, but where there are gaps, we're going with the sagas because it's more fun. So that's what a lot of people are playing with there.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly something I noticed with, of course, going back to the old one of Assassin's Creed Valhalla, because I really enjoy playing their Discovery Tour, which is their kind of like free expansion. Again, they can call it roguelite or not, because it's got no combat at all. It's basically just like free wandering role play, and you encounter all the different things that they were using for not just the concept art, but for that what they then just placed in the game and showing, like, oh, we looked at this artifact in this museum in this wonderful country over here, and then we've put it here, and ta-da. And I really kind of like that, because of course it's got that educational angle of kind of like enabling people to see these artifacts that really existed, and that's what they're basing it on, without having to travel around the world and see things. Like, I know it's got an amber bead that I think Dr. Kat Jarman bound. I think it was amber bead. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it is.
You're nodding, Emma, so I'm going to assume I'm right. And I know in terms of runes and Old Norse language, they had an acquaintance of mine called Marja Vakvel. I can never get her surname right, but I kind of like always do want to see her name on there, kind of thing. because I know they've gone to reputable people about reputable things, because, of course, you as historians and those who study the literature and know about what really happened to a degree, because of course we never really know what truly happened and what these people truly thought, can kind of understandably get a bit, I guess, a bit wrinkled about seeing certain interpretations taken too far or using the words or the old language or items in the wrong way kind of thing. It's, I mean, I personally just have a pee with Assassin's Creed having to mine with your actual weapon, but that's not, it's just, it just takes out the realism of that particular aspect entirely, even though you do have a blacksmith in your village, so why can't you just hire someone to mine? But anyway, that's something else for Ubisoft Studios to sort out and all that kind of thing. So I guess both as players and as creators, we almost have to have that imaginary fourth wall, have to suspend our disbelief and allow the slightly impossible to happen, because if we don't, then are we limiting or not confined? Well, limiting ourselves in kind of like what we can do. Because I guess it's almost like deciding what rules to have in a game. You have so many rules to allow so much to happen, but then if you don't have this rule, then that won't happen, I suppose. In my very rambling way of saying something sensible.
Yeah, I think it is tricky for game designers, for players, for scholars of any kind, whether that be professional or not, in terms of how do you balance all the different concerns of a game while still trying to, I guess, not misconstrue something in a way that's unhelpful or problematic. So what I kind of, I guess, encourage is just going for that historical resonance rather than necessarily outright accuracy. Like, does this feel true, if not necessarily real, in the sense of like, are the elements there, and just approaching things from a historically expansive mindset rather than historically limiting. So obviously Viking gender is a really hot topic, and we can prescribe a lot of rules on that. We can say like, you can't play a woman in games and things like that, but actually let's kind of explore what you can do as those sort of people and in those spaces.
It's very true. Certainly, it makes me think back to the way Disney have kind of put that little blurb in front of some of their films now, especially kind of like with Peter Pan, saying this film depicts certain views of a certain type of person, and we just, you know, we're in the 21st century now, we don't hold those views anymore, but this was made back then, and so please just forgive them and move on, because we can't go back and challenge and correct them. So I sometimes get a bit puzzled as to why some people want some of their old Dahl books to be rewritten, and because some language he uses might be found as insulting now, but I'm thinking, well, they were read for generations. If they haven't been found insulting then, is it us that's changed compared to the medium, or is it the medium that's now had a perspective change, I suppose, but then that's back on us. But I guess it's interesting to see in terms of how gameplay works and representation of, not just like, as I mentioned, about women, either she or maidens or all of us. Because quite often everyone wants to be the fighter, they want to be the strong type, they want to be the one going around wielding a shield and an axe and raiding a longship, or not raiding a longship, well, you could do, I suppose, sailing a longship and that kind of thing. They don't want to miss out on the big actions and the imagery that we have associated with Vikings. But yeah, so I think we're going to have to wrap it up, because I know I've been talking to you both for a very long time, because it's very late at the time of this recording, dear viewers and listeners, and I know these guys, at least certainly I do, I will want some sleep at some point. But I hope you've both enjoyed this really insightful conversation. I think we've touched on all sorts so much, and the conversation's had a lovely natural meander and flow on all these topics. So I thank you very much for your time, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
If anyone viewing or listening wants to check out what you're studying or researching, is there anywhere they can go? Have you got any articles, works that you can point them to, or just direct you to follow them on socials, etc.?
Emma?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what my handles are on various places. So I'm still on Twitter/X at EMLTHOM. But I'm otherwise RK Emma on Blue Sky and Instagram. So ARCHA and then Emma. And then, yeah, in terms of things coming up, I'm back on Nordic Mythology podcast next month, sometime or the month after. And there are a few of those kicking around as well. But yeah, stuff in pipeline will emerge on the platforms as and when they do.
Very good.
Yeah, I am on Twitter at at Uka A. Panaro. I don't really post there much. I should do more. I did send you, Becky, the link to my first publication, which is on the first Norse God of War. It's a very deep dive on how it plays and subverts the prose Edda, kind of the main Norse mythological text, how it turns that on its head. And I do expand that a bit in the article that will be in our mutual volume from the Stavanger conference. Otherwise, yeah, I don't have anything.
It's all good.
Couple of articles, yeah, eventually. Good.
It's all good, because of course we're all busy in our own lives. You know, you, Emma, you teach at university, do you not?
I've taught a little bit about Viking death, so I got to tell some third year students at midday on a Wednesday, you know, what happens when you die, and got some lovely looks in response. But yeah, I dabble.
Cool. And do you do any kind of like academic work on the side as well, Luke, or are you just researching mainly?
Oh, no, I also teach every now and then. Actually, this fall, I'll get to teach another course, or a rehash of a course that I got to teach for the first time 2 years ago, which is explicitly on a popular Viking reception. It's taught in thirds with someone on my committee who does museum studies approaches to Vikings, and she's really into also like reenactment, metal festivals, HEMA type stuff. So she talks about all of that. Someone else will be talking about Viking movies and TV shows, and I'll be doing Viking video games in the third, in the last third. So I'm really looking forward to that in the fall.
Sounds really good. I wish I could be part of that class. just because I love to learn anything to do with Vikings. And of course, Modern Perception is a huge rainbow spectrum of content. It's why I do this podcast, because there's so much out there. But thank you very much for your time. We've definitely talked more and longer than I thought, but I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoy your sleep after this episode. and thank you, dear viewers and listeners, wherever you're watching. Please hit subscribe wherever you are so you don't miss out on the next Valhalla Conversations episode, episode 16, which will feature a lovely author friend of mine called Genevieve Cornishek. She has written two books, The Witch's Heart and a really great one called The Weaver and the Witch Queen, about Gunhild and Eric Bloodhax. And she herself is undertaking a journey into academic research herself very soon. I believe it's with Iceland as well. So I'll be quizzing her and asking her on how I can get on board and escape my part-time job and being a parent. If only someone could pay me to do it. But anyway, thank you very much for listening, and we shall hopefully see and speak to you all again soon. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussions between my special guests and myself. Please do check out the episode blurb for links to their works and websites. If you liked this episode, let me know by giving it a thumbs up. Let me know if you learned something new in the comments. And of course, click subscribe to Valhalla Conversations wherever you are listening or watching. This podcast can be watched on YouTube and YouTube Music. And it can also be listened to on Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, and on RSS.com. We hope you can join us in Valhalla again soon for more conversations.